Hey, Startup Hustle listeners, before we get into today's episode, I've got some exciting news to share. If you've enjoyed the insights and stories here at Startup Hustle, you're going to love what we have in store at our brand new podcast called Product Driven. I've always described myself as a product guy first, entrepreneur, software engineer, but really a product guy. I love building products. Many people struggle, though, with how to take a product idea and build a tech product, while software engineers struggle to understand the business side of things and they just don't see the big picture. My new podcast, Product Driven, is about that gap between business and the tech side of building software. It's designed for startup founders, tech leaders, software engineers, and anyone who loves tech and startups. Thank you for being part of this community. Enjoy this episode of Startup Hustle, and please subscribe to Product Driven in your podcast app, and you can also check it out on YouTube. Thank you so much.
And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io. And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle. Matt DeCourcy here to have another conversation I'm hoping helps your business grow. So what is raising capital? You know, you hear all about it, and startups are always talking about all the capital that they raise or all the capital they're going to raise. But really, like, what is that? And it's exactly what we're going to talk about today. And I have got the perfect guest to have that discussion with. But before I tell you who that is, I want to let you know that this episode of Startup Hustle is brought to you by Silicon Valley Bank, who might be the right episode sponsor to discuss raising capital during. But SVB has been supporting innovative founders, companies, and investors with targeted financial services and expertise for over 35 years. Silicon Valley Bank, they're built for what's next. Learn more at svb.com. Really easy, SVB. So with me today, I've got Ron Shigeta, and Ron is not a first-time guest. And I think last time he was on, I may have touted him as being one of the most credentialed or smartest people. And my wife always says, how'd your podcast go? And I'm often like, well, I talked to someone who has done doctoral training at Princeton University and is a biotech entrepreneur and a co-founder and chief science officer. Well, anyway, Ron, welcome to Startup Hustle. Welcome back.
Thanks, Matt. Great to be here again.
Well, I appreciate you coming back and letting me talk about how smart you are. So,
music players.
Well, yeah. So, and if it helps with your wife or someone, you need to say, hey, look, you know, this guy was talking about all the smart stuff I've done, but Ron, you really have. And you're like, you are involved in the startup world. You're out in Berkeley, California. And I'm sure it's warmer there than the snowy terrain I'm looking at here in Kansas City. The day after we lose the Super Bowl,
I need to code outside.
We're sad and cold in Kansas City today.
It was a tough weekend.
Why don't you let me warm myself up while you let everyone listening reintroduce yourself and give us a little bit about your background?
Great. So I have a PhD, but actually I was doing sort of regular sciencey stuff as a staff scientist. And I just thought, you know, just like a lot of your guests, I decided I was going to make a change. And I started out being a little bit of an entrepreneur in biotech, and I ended up being an investor for a few years. I've worked with about 100 startup teams. I've funded over 70% of them. And I just really, like, the whole space is exploding and the world is interesting every day. And that's why I get out of bed, and it's a lot better than, you know, what I used to do. So I love life, and I just love being doing what I'm doing and just being here and other places what I get to see. You know, it's great.
You know, we had so much fun talking about just stuff last time you were on. But as you mentioned, you know, being involved in your timeline with 100 different startups and being, well, you've been on both sides of the table. And I think that's important to have as we begin to have a conversation about what is raising capital. Now, look, don't assume that you know what raising capital is, because until you've done it, there's a lot of stuff to figure out. So we're going to get into the who, what, where, when, why, and how. But first off, maybe we start with who. So like, Ron, who raises capital? Like, who are the who?
Yeah, that's a question. Isn't sort of like, it kind of depends on who you are. It means a lot of things to different people, right? So if you're like, have a local business and you want to sort of set up dry cleaning, you might be able to go to the bank and just get a loan to start your business. Most people talk about venture capital when they're talking about raising capital. And that is for people who have this completely outrageous ambition to make a company that's super valuable. They're going to use technology or some brilliant idea or experience they've had to turn it into basically corporate value. And you can find a whole bunch of investors out there now who want to help you do that. And they're going to sort of invest in you and come along with you for the ride and share your journey. And that's sort of what's been the most amazing thing in the past few years. The availability of venture capital is exploding, people are scouring the earth looking for great opportunities.
And you're right on about that. And, you know, I think at one point, a lot of people associated raising capital, oh, you got to be in Silicon Valley or wherever. Like, there's a lot of money flowing into everywhere that's coming out of a lot of the traditional hubs for raising capital. And we'll get into that in the where section. But as far as like who, you've got like founders, you have equity holders, whoever has the future mapped out.
You've got your cousin who got a retirement, you know, got his retirement account open. You know, like friends and family are some of the first places that people like to raise money, you know, and that's great, because before you really have anything, these are the people who will start you off with $5,000 or $10,000, or just a hug and living in the garage there while you put together your website or what have you. And then when you actually have something ready to go, then there's lots of places, pretty much anywhere in the world now, where you can sort of reach out and try to let people know, hey, I'm ready to show what I've got, and you know, I want to raise some money. I want to raise $500,000 or $200,000 or maybe even more to sort of really start turning this into something very real. And I guess I work with a lot of these people too, Matt. Like, this is no strange thing to you.
So as we have such an amazing research team at Startup Hustle now, they've given me a definition of raising capital, which I think is fair to share. Raising capital is when an investor or a lender gives a business funds to assist with starting, growing, and managing day-to-day operations. Typically, you have two forms. You have equity or you have debt.
Right.
So would you like to take the reins on clarifying those?
Sure, let's do that. So, you know, like I say, banks and lending institutions or anybody who'll give you a loan with charging interest that you'll pay back over time, you know, that's a debt financing. There's actually several different levels of debt financing, as you can imagine. And they depend on how much revenue you have. If your company is raising money, selling things and making income for it, either a business, either something, an object you're selling, a product, or you're selling services, those incomes will sort of create a credit record for your business. And so you can usually go to the bank after you've got about 6 months to a year of revenue like that, that's substantial, and be able to open a line of credit. If you go to someplace like Silicon Valley Bank or Bank of America, when you start, if you've got a decent credit rating, you'll actually get a credit line with a business account. You'll usually make $10,000-$20,000. But those are all debt financings. If the company goes bankrupt, then, you know, you really won't have to pay it back. But of course, your credit rating will sort of like be reflecting your credit record. And then, you know, then there's equity financing. Equity financing is where you're basically taking on a partner. It can be an active partner or a silent partner. The active partner would be like a co-founder or someone who's going to actually literally work in the office with you and really actively put their hands into it and get things going with you. But the passive partners, they have a lot of capital and they want to sort of give some of that to you to have shares of the company. So you can have a 10% investor or 20% investor. And the terms of that depend upon how how valuable people think the company is. And so there's lots of categories there in terms of what kind of terms you get when you do either of these kinds of funding. It just depends on how big you are and how big they think you will be.
And that's completely variable. I mean, there's not like a template. I mean, while there are similarities in a lot of deals, I mean, every deal is its own separate deal. And so much of that is, you know, so you talk about, we talked about who, so you have the who and the what, and we're talking about, you know, equity and debt financing. And then there's actually some weird kind of little hybrid mixes of the two. And I think that we kind of sidestep those because, you know, we could probably talk for hours just about those things and want to kind of keep things moving. But, you know, overall, when it comes to equity financing, well, either equity or debt financing have different levels of complexity and availability depending on the industry you're in as well. Like there are really overwhelmingly the quote VC or venture capital model is very driven towards enterprise software right now. And that's like, you know, so if you have a service business, well, Full Scale as a service business, you know, and that's right. We provide tech services, but the same kind of companies that probably hold their bank accounts at Silicon Valley Bank are not doing the same thing we're doing. And where specialty banking institutions and investors come in is when they're looking for something that's in their lane or in their wheelhouse and they'll be rarely upfront. You know, they'll say, hey, we don't invest in services businesses, or we don't do products or different things. Yeah. So
they need to evaluate and they need to speak from experience when they do that. But
you know what
I find a very relatable way to understand this, Matt, is Shark Tank. If you like Shark Tank, you know, that's almost all equity financing, but you can sort of see how it's changed over the years. Like, you know, just a few years ago, for the first maybe 10 or 10 seasons or so of Shark Tank, they were all local. There were a lot of local businesses. I remember some watching some like where we're going to have a party sort of party company. We bring in the birthday party for the kids. We bring in the bounce house. We do all these things. And the stocks will say something like, here's $250,000. I want 51% of the company. You know, that is debt finance, or that's equity financing. They're going to give you money. They're going to take a certain percentage, and they're going to sort of demand to have their say in certain things because they're a major partner. And that's sort of like those kind of companies in the early Shark Tank. Those were sort of local businesses, and their total value could have been around in the millions of dollars, say, if they finally reach their full potential. You know, and so the terms are kind of sharp. Like the investors want a big chunk for enough money to get started. And, you know, they're looking at an upside of several million dollars probably, but there's a lot of risk between here and there. And so that's one kind of deal. But Shark Tank has been turning more and more to venture capital sort of mode lately. And my startup Wild Earth actually was one of the first ones to show up on Shark Tank, you know, and it was kind of startling. At the time, it was one of the largest deals ever. Mark Cuban invested $500,000 for 10% of the company. And that may have been the largest deal on Shark Tank in terms of amount of money that changed hands at the time. But there has been more and more sort of startup type of deals where the company has potential to be worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And the amount of investment and the percentage that you get for that investment, those ratios change a lot. So it kind of depends on the size of your ambition and what you're doing and how people value it, right? And so, you know, if you want to raise a lot of money and make a great company, you've put that out early on and people believe in you, you'll get very different terms than if you're opening a dry cleaning place or, you know, you want to open a tattoo parlor or whatever else you're interested in.
Yeah. And that's that industry specific, you know, like any of these, we can talk a little bit about the where of things. Yeah. So like, where do you get the money? In terms of raising capital in the VC landscape, those are funds, and those are funds that that the institution or the fund itself, as we could talk about, goes out and they do a separate form of raising capital. They are wanting to find high net worth individuals that have an interest in investing in business. Now, look, all these funds are different. Some of they're like, you are a biotech guy, and there are biotech funds. There are funds for just about everything in this day and age, but a different form of capital raising has to occur before that money is available. So the people that invest in those funds, they want to lean on the institution to make the smart decisions and do the work. They provide the capital to be invested. Although in some of those, in some funds, you'll find that they may be anchored or at least started in principle by someone who had a generous portion of cash and then found others that, you know, cash attracts cash. It's an amazing thing. Yeah. Well, yeah. So
trust you as an investor a little bit more too. That was my first boss investing was for a fund called SOSV. And Sean O'Sullivan was the principal there, and you know, started almost all of the money was originally his, and now they've expanded. That is a good way to get started. You know, the most amazing thing about venture capital is, you know, like you were saying earlier, maybe about 10 years ago, everything was in Silicon Valley. There were like maybe 20 or 30 firms in the whole world that did this. I actually tried to find out how many venture capital sort of firms.
That a lot. Were.
I think it's over 5,000, Matt.
yeah, right.
I mean, every state, almost every country has venture capital firms now, and they fly all over looking for people for opportunities everywhere. It's really changed. The game has changed completely, hasn't it?
Well, and you know, some of that is driven by the fact that, well, and I'm not going to get too deep into the economics of stuff, but while the stock market has been on a bull run for a while, there's a lot of people with a lot of money that they look at an 11% return and they're like, just a lot of people want to be rock stars these days. And the thing is the upside for the investor depends on the stage that they come in. The stage they come in at represents different levels of risk and a whole lot of other stuff. But there's a level of diversification that people are putting out there because an IPO is great and stock does what it does when it's publicly traded. But the real return is getting in early.
That's right.
Going along for the ride. It's also the bumpiest, dirtiest ride that you could pick.
Though. It is dirty, but you know, you're right. That's where all the gains are. And what's happening is that companies are starting out on the public markets, on the stock market, much later. You know, it used to be you're worth $100, $200 million. You go on to the stock exchange and then you raise capital on there and slowly will go to multiple billions of dollars. You know, over 10, 12 years. That's not true. You know, Facebook rolls out. I think the first week it was $300 billion in value or $100 billion in value. You know, most of that early upside was taken up in venture capital. And people just, you know, when you have that kind of money, you kind of want to own that stuff and make that a personal deal that you make. And there's less regulation. And so there's a lot more freedom to sort of like help people in different ways. And sort of also dictate terms. So a lot of money is moving to venture capital for that reason. Even some pension funds and so forth, they're putting money in venture capital firms. It's not all in stock anymore.
Yeah, and that's that, you know, now these funds and the people that are investing in them, this is a higher level of risk than, I mean, the institutional investors and people that are running funds and firms that we've had on the show in the past, I mean, they'll flat out tell you they're hoping to be right 1 out of 10 times. Like,
that's right.
They invest in 10 companies expecting 9 of them to tank. It's one that does it that pays for all of it.
And that one might improve in value. They might yield 100-fold. You know, actually, some of the funds are even better than that. If you're a startup, it doesn't matter who gives you money, really, as long as they're fairly honest about it. But you know, if you're investing in funds, it makes a big difference who you get in with. I was actually at a summer camp for one of the more successful funds in the Valley, and the senior partner got up early and he said, "The last fund raised 10,500%." it was up. I mean, it was a 10-year fund, but it was a a 100-fold return, you know, and it's pretty hard to beat that. And that's why there's so many people getting into that game. And that's a good thing for people who are looking for venture investment. You know, if you want equity investment, if you understand, you know, what to do and what they want to, what they're looking for, and you can be that, you know, it's great. You can get a lot of help, right?
So and you see a lot of like interesting parallel things coming out. Like, well, another supporter of Startup Hustle is a platform called Our Crowd, who helps accredited investors invest alongside funds. And you know, like, and some of that is you mentioned when we said money attracts money. It really does. It really does. But there are firms that are really marquee out there that when they put their money into something, it's now sent up a signal flare that usually that in almost every case will bring a tidal wave or a tsunami or whatever of additional investment on. So, you know, there's a lot of markers and things out there that, and a lot of interesting opportunities for people to do interesting things. Once again, with a high level of risk.
Yeah, it is. It's a high level of risk. And it's a little like high school over again, because there's popular people, and there's different cliques there, and you kind of wish you're hanging out with the cool crowd. And everybody's trying to get in that. And it's a lot easier for some people than others. So unfortunately, like anything, it's about understanding the game and the people and what they want. It's not super easy either, but you know, it's rewarding. But there are, you know, nobody, I'm not going to say that this is not something with a lot of gain. You know, you know, when there's money, there's also politics and cliques and all that weird stuff that we used to see. So, you know, it's not all completely perfect, but everybody's doing something so different. It's really hard for someone to be an expert in whatever comes along. And so it's important to learn how to communicate and understand yourself. To sort of like make sure that you get your message across, because a lot of people, I think they really don't have as much attention as they could have, because they don't really talk about themselves. They don't really understand what's valuable and put it out there. That really increases your chances to get some good attention.
Well, speaking about things that a good place to start, what does it say on your shirt right now?
This is a Y Combinator is one of those places you can go and get in, and they'll put you in front of a great bunch of investors. This is their t-shirt. Make something people want. You know, if you don't do that,
it's a good place to start.
Nobody wants, like, what, you know, it's kind of, it's just another good reminder about why we're all here. You know, it's all about your customer. Yeah.
And we've spent, you know, Matt Watson and I tune in on Wednesdays in 2021 for Matt Watson and I spending the year talking about how to start a tech company. And, you know, we're 5 episodes into that, and we haven't really started talking about the tech part of the company, because there's a really strong foundation. Like, there's just certain things, like, does your business solve a problem? You know, and do people value that solution, which is making something people want? Now, here's the thing. I'm going to argue with your shirt a little bit, because you can make things that people want, but they still don't have they still might not have a high monetary value.
That's true.
And so that's another tricky thing. And, you know, so you look at something like Facebook. So Facebook's product is you. It's you and I as users on Facebook, and they're selling our eyeballs to advertisers, which is something people want, exposure and whatever. But there's a different solution and a different approach and a different value and product market fit. So Watson and I just recorded an episode about why startups fail. The number one reason is that they don't have a good product market fit, which was basically saying they've made something that people don't want or don't find incredibly valuable.
Yeah, it's important not to see advice like this and say that's everything, right? It's like the first step of a very long, painful journey, right?
But if you don't get that part right, nothing else matters.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're never done getting good advice and learning more about what you're doing. I mean, are you really? I'm sure you guys stand around Full Scale and talk about this too. Like, you know, there's always another sort of hill to climb and a new way to sort of like, you know, help your customers. Certainly, you know, spending 4 months at Y Combinator may help you raise even several million dollars, but it's not going to solve that problem. that's going to be going on for years and years and years. And you've got to like it. You've got to like digging into yourself and saying, what the hell's wrong here? You know, what can you do now? That's the tough part about it that we don't really talk about. It's glorious to get investment, but then people only want to invest you if you're really going to make that money and turn it into something real. And that's why you're there. And if you lose sight of that, you're going to lose everybody's attention real fast. Ultimately,
that's that is easy to do. Now, on your way to raising capital, if you, and we're going to talk about, you know, the when here in a second, but when you do, I know that the folks over at Silicon Valley Bank would like you to talk to them about working with you and your raise. So I've learned so much about Silicon Valley Bank since they started supporting us. Like they are the banking behind 50%, near roughly 50% of Series A everything, which is crazy. So
they actually, you know, I know them too. They came and helped us out at, when I was doing my own accelerator, which is IndieBio, is pretty successful. They smelled that success. They came in. They really helped us. They supported us all kinds of ways, and you know they look at it
a little different. And we'll talk about some of that in a minute. And just as a reminder, this episode of Startup Hustle is brought to you by Silicon Valley Bank. Go to svb.com. They've been helping founders, startups, companies, investors with a lot of stuff. And you know, I've had the privilege of getting to know them. They look at a tech business differently than the bank, than the traditional bank, which is crazy still on many levels. And so many days just still do not seem to understand how tech businesses work. You know, they want to, you know, it's like, I don't know. It's like I could go on and on and on because I'm kind of passionate about this because I don't understand how a bank like, well, you're an investor. So you own shares in early stage businesses that aren't publicly traded, much like I do. Go down to your local bank and try to get a loan against that or get them to even recognize it exists. And for those of you not watching the live stream, Ron is shaking his head from side to side because they don't give a shit.
You might
and I'm sitting here going, but they care about a tractor trailer full of bolts that they'll never sell. If they have to repo them, because it's just, there's a lot of, so finding a bank that actually understands what the hell you need and how you need it is great. So let's talk about the when. So, and another thing, we're going to squeeze this into the when, but you got a valuation. Mm-hmm. So before you're going to get into things like pre-seed, seed, Series A, bridge, sidecar, Series B, all of it, like, what's the market price?
You know, it's a lot. You know, I think if it's a sliding scale, I can just say it's like old Shark Tank to new Shark Tank. You know, when you have an idea and it's like no fail, piece of genius, little piece of heaven fell on my head here. You know, you and your co-founders might believe that, but there's a lot of people with ideas and they just don't, you know, they never get around to actually making them real, and giving them people that stage is super risky. And so if you can de-risk, as we say, if you can sort of start to make something that looks real, looks like the seed of something that could actually work and show that this is attractive and that it kind of works the way you hope it will, that substantially increases your value. And so you've got this decision to make. You know, you might be working, you know, your full-time job and coming home or on the weekends, you know, building something, and it's painful. And so you're going to spend a certain amount of time making your MVP, right? Your minimal viable product. And as you start doing this, if it's, the more it works and the closer it is to actually making something, let's say even you start getting users and serving them out some service, you know, for instance, in a web company, then your value will start just increasing dramatically. And it has nothing to do with how good your idea is, it has everything to do about whether or not you're actually going to make something real. That is much more valuable than a brilliant idea. Brilliant ideas. There are so many millions of people out there.
They're everywhere.
They come along a lot more than you
think. They're free. How many do you want?
I have a notebook with a new idea almost every day.
Dude, it's funny you say that because I say the same thing. People like, I have a great, I'm like, great idea. I got a book too, man. I mean, you want million-dollar ideas. Those are free. They're everywhere. It's the execution that trades at a premium, and that's part of, like, so when we talk about the when, So when you're in this pre-seed, like meaning like you don't have anything, like Ron, you and I, we have an idea. Now we got to find someone to pay for it. So, well, first off, what a lot of people do, like Watson and I, we started Full Scale out of our own bank accounts. We don't have any investors. We never have. We probably never will. So that's one way that a lot of people raise capital. It's out of their own bank account. But if you can't do that, or you need to get it from somewhere else, what you're selling in that earliest of stages is more about you in many cases than it is about your idea. So if you're, and this is going to sound shitty, but if you've never done anything, you don't have any street cred, you don't have a history, and now you're out there going, hey, look, I'm raising money at you. God, I don't even want to know how many times you've seen this.
It goes even deeper.
I've got nothing. I have no history. I haven't done this before, but I'm raising at $4 million. I have no revenue. We haven't even written a line of code. In fact, this one pager is as far as this company has gone, but I need $4 million, Ron. Yeah. Am I going to get it?
The answer will be, I'll take 98% of the company if I really like the idea.
Yeah, right. Right. For next to nothing. Yeah.
And for you, like, here's $5,000. You know what? I'm laughing because in addition to all these other things about being real at that point, like some people won't even dress themselves properly and do those pitches. Like, you know, people are looking for all these small signals that you really care. If you're not really, because we're not talking about a great idea and $1 billion, we're talking about 10 years of the founders' lives. And if they're going to bolt and run when it looks like it's too hard, everything's lost. Right. And so that's the source of all the risk. Is everybody just going to give up and go home when it gets tough? That's what people are mostly banking on. They really want to meet you, and you have to
want to see your passion.
You got to be clear,
passionate. Because if you don't have passion for it, you're going to quit. Just like Ron was just saying, it's like, will you bolt and run when this gets hard? If you're not passionate about the company, the solution, about all of it, yeah, you will. I mean, I can almost. I'm not even giving 98% there. I'm saying it's a 99%.
Can I have the car? It's like you're 16. You just got your license. There's no way. You know, it's really not how smart you are. And people think it is about how smart you are. And if you start making out that, hey, all I've got is I'm really smart, you know, you'll be sitting by yourself at the table. it's mysterious.
That's my new one pager, because I'm really smart. I've dropped out of 5 colleges, Ron. If I go back, like at one point, my notes tell me that your doctoral training at Princeton University studying protein structure and biophysics. All right. So I'm not that smart. But there's a lot of smart people out there. But at the same time, like you went to school with a bunch of people that were doing the other stuff too. Like that's not the primary core differentiator.
It is not.
Now, maybe if you have unique expertise in something that other people don't have, and your idea goes well with that, that becomes a good fit. But
technology, I mean, that you have a patent that prevents other people from competing with you, that has a certain amount of value. But one of the great things, I'd say one of the things that people don't know about going to the Ivy League is you realize that, you know, there are certain things that doesn't get you. And one of them is being smart enough to deserve money just for being smart. Like that's all too common, you know, and that's the main gift, as I know that really well. You know, you need more than that.
So you talk about these different stages, and with these different stages come varying levels of expectation. Like if you're going to find investors in a pre-seed and these seed rounds, like they're going to want more. Like the risk, that's where the risk is the highest for the investor. So when do you begin to determine, like when do you raise money, Ron?
Well, I think, at a certain point when you have what you think is a good minimal viable product, something that shows that your concept actually can work, it can attract people, it can make sense to customers, you have product to show the investors and they believe in it, then, you know, you can start with a seed round. And at the baseline, there's a bunch of accelerators like Y Combinator, like IndieBio. There's advisors like me who will sort of jump on early and sort of get to this stage. But when you get to your seed round, you've got a reasonable, strong indication of a minimal viable product and that you can live. And then you can negotiate for seed round. The one thing people often skip over is when you propose your company to attract a good venture capital investment, the long-term projection should be worth hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue a year. And people kind of skip over that, and they don't really understand the magnitude of that number. And so it's important to sort of put that in there. But if you're showing a valuable company, you can probably raise between $2 and $8 million now, depending on how good that pitch is and how good that projection is. And you would be, you know, should we explain pre-money and post-money valuation here? You know, you say you can give the, so often we give the pre-money valuation to the company. So if I'm raising 6 on 10, it means that my company is worth $10 million. The investors are going to give me 6. And then after that transaction, the company worth $16 million, which means, you know, that you've sold 6 out of 16% of your company, that fraction, right? So
Let's explain that for a second, because because I think a lot of people complicate this, because and by the way, you also don't want to be wrong about this, because you might find that you accidentally sold more for less. But basically with pre and post money, it's like you, Ron's talking about, he's saying 6 on 10. Okay, so I'm going to sell 60% of the company. It's got a $10 million valuation. Now, why is it worth 16 after? It's because the fair market value of shares were $10 million. And that company just also now has $6 million in the bank.
That's right. And so we actually created more shares. So there's $16 million worth of shares. The number of shares everybody holds does not change, but we created more shares for these investors to get
that. Which also technically means you didn't sell 60%. And no, it'll end up being like 55.6 or I don't know. It'll be something weird.
Around 40%.
And this is where you're diluting your ownership position. And you hear a lot of stuff like, I think that these things are very overwhelming for people that haven't gotten into it. I remember the first time I sat in a room full of people and talking about this, and I was sitting there thinking, I was like, shit, I got to learn some stuff. And I was actually in Manhattan, like New York, Manhattan. And I came out of this one afternoon meeting, and I had a whole bunch the next day. And I literally stayed up all night in the hotel because I didn't feel comfortable about my level of, like, I'm pretty quick with my math, but I wasn't like, I really knew I needed to get it, because that isn't where I wanted to mess up the deal. It's actually pretty easy to realize and understand, but know what you're talking about, because pre-money and post-money valuations, that can be a really big difference.
And you got to understand what that means for you, because, you know, you can, if you raise more money, it means you're giving up a larger chunk of your company. And so it's great to have $6 million on the bank, but if you just sold off 40% of the shares, the founders, you know, when you have less than 50% of the shares of the company between you and the founders, then you decisions are made by a vote, by shares. And so you won't, if you get in sort of an argument with your investors, they really don't like it. You will actually not be able to make the decision you want. And losing that control is an important thing. And I don't recommend losing it real quick. You know, ideally what you'd like to do is sell off 20-ish, up to 20% of the company in that round, which means you're going to take less money, right? That's basically a little over $2 million on a $10 million pre-money valuation, right? Maybe you could get someone, they might offer you 4 if you're hot, you'll get oversubscribed. But if you take that money, you're edging yourself closer to losing control of your company. And when that happens, just like you were that night you went to, you know, in the hotel room in New York, you also want to be prepared for that. What happens when I lose control of the company? How's that going to go? How does someone operate? How does a CEO or a C-suite team, how do they operate under those conditions? And you've got to be prepared for these things before they come up. If we do that 6 on 10 deal, you're going to lose your money the next round of investment, probably. You're going to not be able to actually have absolute control of your own company, right? Got to be ready for that.
So 20 minutes before we hit record on this, I was actually had a friend of mine from high school who had set an appointment with me. He reached out over the weekend and he had some questions about, he was starting a business. And he said, well, what's some advice you can give me? And I said, don't sell away control of your company for pennies on the dollar. Because he was just like, he was going to get about, he's selling about 10% ownership. And I said, look, I wouldn't give any control or anything. I said, and he had two different investors, $1 million valuation, $250,000 investors. I said, don't let them tell you that they want to create a board. And you're immediately outvoted on for people that own 10% of the company. And that's, and this is a big thing. So, you know, now at some point, if your business gets big enough, it's going to be bigger than you. You're not going to, you do have to cede control in some regards, because right. there aren't people typically aren't going to write you $20 million checks and they just have absolutely no control with it.
Yeah.
So, you know, but that's always a hot topic. And
it is.
And that's a risk that you take. It's like, some people will tell you, they're like, hey, if you have the chance to raise the money, do it, because you don't know what's going to happen later.
It's part of growing up, Matt. You know, like,
yeah,
when you've learned to, you know, handle the relationship with everybody else on the board and all your investors and make them believe in you without complete control, you know, it's kind of like, it's like becoming an adult all over again. You're managing these relationships through soft power and through just sort of good vibes, you know, but we all have to work up to it, you know. But I think, you know, you put your finger on it, though. I mean, if you really care about the business and it really are, you really have ambitions for it, you should plan on losing control over it at some point. If you're going to go multinational and have $300 million, you're going to need so much money, you're not going to stay in control. But you can still call the shots. You just have to do it with other people watching. Kind of like,
well, but a lot of founders, I think you talk about turning into an adult and growing up, you know, and at Full Scale, while we don't have partners, we talked to a few people about it and they would ask, you know, like I've told them straight up. I said, look, if you can ever find someone that's going to do my job better than me, let's put them in.
Mm-hmm.
Put them
mm-hmm.
in, coach, you know, and mm-hmm. that's part of that compromise and maturity and other things. Cause you know, one of the things people don't want is a bratty founder that is stubborn. And, you know, like, I mean, there's so many, the complexity in these deals is actually the humans, not the math and the mechanics. And then, you know, another thing too, is one of the things that, you know, okay, have you ever had, this isn't a question to you, but this is a question. Have you ever had $5 million in your bank account? Because some people can't handle that shit. They can't. Yeah. They're just like, you know, that money comes in and they have a big, we're going to have a launch party and spend $500,000 or something dumb, you know? And that's part of it too, is like, can you handle it? Have you been, and this goes all the way back to that street cred thing. Like, if you're 22 years old and you haven't done anything yet, and you're like, that's going to come up. It's going to be a discussion of can this guy or this girl or any of these folks, can they handle all of it?
You know, Matt, that's actually one of my sayings that I sometimes say, like, there is no extra bonus for doing this completely by yourself. You know, if you can cross the line and go public or have an exit, even if other people were sort of like pulling you over the line in a stretcher, like that's as good as anything else. You know, I mean, these things just barely happen. And the important thing is to sort of like be the kind of person, optimize yourself to maximize the chances of you actually getting across the finish line. Nothing else matters. Nobody's going to say like, oh my God, and he didn't need any advice. And like, I've never heard, who ever heard about that for anybody? Like nobody says that, you know, who cares, right? You know how so like out of control these things can be. You know, I was listening to a podcast about PayPal, you know, and you've got Max Levchin, you've got like Reid Hoffman, you know, Elon Musk, you've got these giants, right, of industry now. And it was their first success. They sold PayPal to eBay for $1.6 billion. And then in the podcast, like the primary three founders, except for Musk, who is sort of like in his own pool, they say like, and those three people walked away with $100 million. That means that they were holding like 8% of the shares of eBay when it sold. You know, that's how much they were over leveraged. And then they went and took that money and they did some spectacular things with it. But you got to understand that like they were just focused on just getting it done. And they did. And that's why they're successful. Not because, for no other reason.
Well, 8% of something that's worth $1.6 billion is a lot more than 58% of something that's worth $10
million. Or nothing.
Or nothing. That's right. Right.
People don't, people don't do that math. You know, I think, you know, one thing I'll just tell you, like, it's funny, investors never want to upset you. So they'll never tell you what they're really thinking. But I will tell you, and I think they'll appreciate it because I want someone else to tell you. But, you know, to the startup people, you know, if people are looking at you, the one thing they want from you personally is called coachability. That doesn't mean that you're going to knuckle under and take whatever advice and kowtow to anybody. They want people to stand on their own, but they also want someone who will listen to everything, think it over, and take the best course given that information. If you are not susceptible to influence, you drop in the ranks severely. And in my book too, I don't want to work with someone who thinks they know better than everybody they meet. I don't feel like people have to take my advice, but, you know, by and large,
but it's listen to it. Just take it in. That's why I said no one wants it. Like, investors don't want a bratty founder. And that goes in that same regard. Like, look, there are so many people out there looking for investment. There are so many opportunities out there. You can get in your own way in a hurry with your shitty attitude or your closed-mindedness or just something goofy. You know, and I've seen it occur. You know, it's kind of like, you know, I've had people pitch me or us on stuff, and I'm sitting here thinking, I'm like, yeah, okay, because look, choose your investors wisely. Like you said earlier, you can kind of take money from anyone. That depends on the circumstance. But man, there's so much going on out there. There's so many amazing people that are awesome to work with that I don't know, man. I turned 46 this year. I'm kind of at the point right now where like I would rather just not even have you as a client or be an investor in your company or any of that if you suck to work with or you're a pain in the ass. Because
yeah,
I got better things to do, man.
Yeah, it's a hidden charge in the relationship. It's like now I got to charge you double, you know. And you don't really want to be like, I mean, you can succeed like that, but really, if you're smart, you understand it's not helping you. And if you can wake up to that, you know, you're going to cut years off your time to exit, and people will like you, and you'll have friends, which are all, you know, beyond the money. That's maybe even more valuable if you think about it, and you can have both. So why not? You know,
well, people and these places aren't writing $5 million, $10 million, $50 million checks to you because they don't want you to succeed. And, you know, it's like, it's one of the things. So Ron, is venture capital bad?
You know, it's sometimes, you know, I think
that was a little bit of a trick question because it depends who you ask, but right.
I mean, I feel, you know, I'm going to be really honest. Like venture capital is on the bad side. Venture capital is the big money moving out of the public markets, not investing with the public to close private deals to soak up early gains super fast. And the rich people get richer. The good side about it and what, you know.
But is it bad for my company and me as a founder?
I don't think so, unless you don't need the money. And if you don't need the money though, it's your fault for taking it. I mean,
one way to end your pitch really quickly is to say, I don't need this money right now. Just let me know.
There's also I'm too valuable for this, which is like, well, you know, I'll be just, you know, the venture capitalist thing. The investment
said that once. I said that once.
There's so many ways to be rude too. But you know, I think that the good side about venture capital is that it creates opportunity for anybody. If you have nothing but a strong work ethic and you really, really have a strong conviction and you've built some skills on your own, you can still succeed. And these people are willing to let you do it. And that is, you know, the one thing I really, really enjoyed about my job is it creates social and economic mobility in a very direct way. You know, some people, I'm not going to name names, but some people I met 6 years ago, they're worth a couple hundred million dollars now. And that's not something you would have thought by looking at them at the time, or maybe even now. But, you know, like, and I'm proud of them for making that happen, you know, and they're making movements behind their products that are changing the world at the same time. I know that's a really trite thing to say, and a lot of people say it, but some amazing innovations, new ideas coming through. And then the people who thought of these ideas and they made it real, they get credit for it. If they were working at, you know, as a researcher in a big company, they would be handing that profit and all that gain over to a large company, and they would get, you know, a pat on the back. Here's a $1,000 bonus check. Now, I've been there, you know, and you can do that. And there's some reasons to do that. But I think having that opportunity is a good thing, you know, and I hope that people will take advantage of it.
So before we move on to the why, the reasons why people raise capital and the how, another quick reminder that today's episode of Startup Hustle is brought to you by Silicon Valley Bank, SVB. And you can go to svb.com to visit their site. Has been supporting innovative founders, companies, and investors with targeted financial services and expertise for over 35 years. Silicon Valley Bank is built for what's next. Learn more at svb.com. So look, everyone wants to know the why, baby. There's a lot of reasons why people raise capital. I mean, and you know, this is that I strategically asked you if it was bad, because I think a lot of people, I mean, I've talked to a ton of people like, yeah, but I don't want venture capital. That's bad. I'm like, explain to me how, like, why wouldn't you want well-resourced, like important, powerful, influential, experienced people helping you get rich?
Yeah. And I think, well, you know, let's talk about, there are some times it's bad. Let's talk about that. And that kind of illuminates when it's good. When it's not right, it's when, like, you actually, it's what you said before, when you really don't need the money. If you can, if you have the resources right now to get yourself to the next level without taking capital, you can do it without diluting yourself. And so that is, you know, but if you can use the resources, right, you're going to, let's say you're going to sell off 25% of the company to take capital, which is a typical round. And the rule of thumb is that will get you about 18 months of run rate. You know, you'll be able to run run with your company and all its employees for 18 months or so on that. You know, during the 18 months, if you're gonna produce something that substantially increases the value of the company, I'm not talking about 25%, that's a wash. If the company increases in value 5 to 6 times for that money, that makes total sense. You know, I sold 25, but I'm 5 times more valuable, right? That's a, you know, that's a 475% increase. You know, that just those numbers will tell you sort of like what, you know, when to make value decisions, right? And venture capital can enable super quick growth. We're in a time when a lot of people are starting their own companies. If you're sitting on an idea that's really great, if you sit there with that idea, you can just watch the internet go by. And within a year, you probably will see someone talking about this idea as their company, you know? And so you do need to move fast now, especially if you're talking about, you know, the web or phones or even biotech and food. You really need to get out there. And so all of these things will make things possible that were really impossible otherwise. That's when the capital is the most valuable.
Yeah, well, and that's the working capital to get to that level. And that's the thing that you know, when you go into that, it's, I often just call it hyper growth. Mm-hmm. The thing is all right, so Full Scale did that for us. We had 100 employees in a year, 200 coming up on 2 years. Honestly, if it wasn't for COVID, I'd probably have 400 employees right now. Okay. But the problem that comes with that is, when we started hiring like 30 people a month, and all of a sudden we had to buy 30 laptops, 30 desks, 30 chairs, it's $100,000 to start 30 people that haven't even showed up and earned a dollar for the company yet. And then you have other things too. So where are they going to work? Oh shit, we need another floor of a building. And you, well, how are we going to handle all these accounts? How are we going to handle all this? Well, we've got to hire some people, but that's not going to happen quickly. We got to get them trained. And it's being able, the capital and this hyper growth periods are exist for you to safely fail in a few spots. Take a couple chances, like, because look, these are very inexact things. Like, anytime you get people involved, there's a zillion variables that come up. Like, you hire the wrong people, or you can't find them at all, or like, well, the reason our business grew so quickly is there's 400,000 open IT jobs in the US that we don't have people to do the work. So people were looking for that, but we still had to find the right people on the other in the Philippines and all these different things. So the cash component, like, once you figure out the formula, you're like, if I have $1 million, I can turn it into five. Now, if you got that formula, raise away, because otherwise you have chicken and egg problems. You have to sit there. You have to earn the money. Oh, God forbid we have to earn the money, Ron. what is going to happen if we have to actually earn the money at our business? Oh, God forbid. But I say that jokingly because if you sit around and wait, well, someone else that has the capital, they have the capital, they have the jet fuel, they have all of them.
Yeah.
They go past you.
You know, I saw you on Clubhouse, man. You know, you think about
Clubhouse.
Oh, no. Isn't that amazing? I mean, here's a company that is exploding.
They have nine employees.
It's a $1 billion company, though.
I know, with nine employees.
You know, when they exploded, they had to be ready. They had to be ready to just like open up a ton of servers at a moment's notice. And they had to have the engine. I'm sure they contracted engineers to come along and make sure that the system's robust enough not to collapse. You know, they had to have a lot of capital in a short period of time. That's an existential moment for them, because Clubhouse wouldn't exist if people come and they find something that doesn't work. They're never coming back. You know that. So some of these companies and these startups, they are structured to be. They have an existential need for capital. They have to have $1 million sitting around for those moments that they're planning on sort of creating. And so
they're defining discipline in many regards too, because that is all of a sudden you see everyone talking about it. Everyone wants an invite. They're literally tapping the brakes. We did it at Full Scale too. I'm not going to say we're a $1 billion company, but we literally at certain times just had to stop. We're like, okay, we're just going to have a waiting list. You can go out of business and you can grow out of business. So like Clubhouse, they've kept it lean, and it's only an iOS app, which has a lot of people bitching. They're like, I can't use this on my Android device. They're getting really, really good at one thing and making sure they can handle it. Why wouldn't you let more users in? Fuck, because maybe we can't handle it because Elon Musk was in there last week. They got to know that platform's not going to take a shit while he's on air.
That's right. I have not walked into a room where the audio didn't work. You know, that beats all the other conferencing systems. You know, it pays to focus. But even so, I'm sure they spent more than $1 million the past couple months just spinning up instances, you know, just making sure the network's working. I sent an invite to a friend in Taiwan. After that, you know, Asia started to explode about that time. You know, they need to be in Asia. You know, you can't run that from the United States. So, there are certain reasons where you really can't do without venture capital, unless you've got $250,000 sticking around or $1 million that you can afford to lose to put into it yourself. And like you said,
and keep in mind too, that's a platform with no revenue.
I know.
I mean, it doesn't cost anything to join or to be on it or to do any of that. So like you getting you past that. All right. If you watch the movie, The Social Network, and whether you love or hate Facebook or Zuckerberg or whomever, you know, early in it, you know, you had Eduardo, his business partner. It's like, we got to sell ads, man. We got to monetize this. And he's like, no, man, it's too early. Like, we want this to be cool before anything else. And that's, by the way, that's like it's not a super feasible approach. It's a weird Silicon Valley approach. And like even the show Silicon Valley, you got that one investor, Russ Hanneman. And it's like, you have a Richard saying, well, we got to monetize. He's like, no, we don't want users. Why would we want revenue? How are we going to raise all this money? If we like, it can't become real. At some point it does have to become real, but you look at some certain things. Like I can, as someone who's a promoter and a kind of a hype man at my own stuff, I like what Clubhouse did. I love exclusivity. I was a ticket broker for 8 years. I understand exclusivity and the value of leaving some people out on the street, man. Because I'm talking about like, say a concert, you want to leave people out on the street because they buy tickets faster. They don't wait to just walk up. If you think you can always walk up and buy them at the box office, why the hell do you buy them 3 months early? The problem is, there's a lot of things that can happen on the day of the show. It could rain, it could snow, you could have a bad day, you could be tired, your dog chewed your pillow up, you know, like, and there's a whole lot of different things. But one thing that Clubhouse is, oh my God, their promos everywhere. And they aren't paid a dime for it. Like, it is literally like
probably the favorite rooms and what happened. And It's an amazing, you know, it's a perfectly designed product. It's viral by itself, you know, can't really do better than that. And I think they've got great places to go, but that's a perfect, you know, that's a perfect Silicon Valley type of strategy, right? You know, the investors are kind of structured for a company like Clubhouse because they don't want Clubhouse to like become financially independent of them right now. They want to actually have these multiple stages where you've got this 5x, 10x growth over a year in value, and then they can put in and buy another 20%. They'll continue to sort of partake of this. And the Clubhouse founders, it's a win-win. They're going to keep going on and they're going to create more value for themselves at the same time. That's what kind of you kind of want to have 5 or 6 years where they're basically the plan is to run on venture capital money and the company's exploding at the same time. That is like the perfect scenario for VC.
And for founders as well, though, because like you mentioned, we don't have to nerd out too much on the math. But if they're reportedly about to raise money at a B, but if they're going to be a $20 billion company, well, that's a pretty big return if you're hanging on to your own share. So, and by the way, I want to say something to anybody that's thinking about raising capital. You never know if you were right or you were wrong until way down the road.
That's right. And then
you got to kind of jump and build wings. What feels good? What seems right? And like there's no, you do not get a game time grade. Well, you can give yourself one, but nobody knows until way down the road.
That's why it's so exciting.
I dig it. Yeah. I think it
has nothing to do with the money.
One of the episodes in our How to Start a Tech series, and once again, check that out. That's Matt Watson and I every Wednesdays on the Startup Hustle podcast. But, you know, we were talking about the traits of a startup, a successful startup founder. And one of the things I said, it's almost a little bit of riverboat gambler. You know, it's like, I mean, and you got to kind of bridge the gap between like, what do you call it? Like, I can't remember the word for someone that has a gambling problem and a riverboat gambler. They're a little different. You got to be ready to like see the bet and make it.
It's a money.
Yeah. So, you know, at the same time, you can't be such a gambler that you're never going to leave the table because eventually you got to cash the chips in, or not. So, all right.
Advantage because they make a lot of investments, and as a founder, you have yours. But that's another symmetry, synergistic sort of thing where you know the founders are going to work harder that way, and that'll improve the risks for everybody.
So, once again, with me today, Ron Shigeta, super entrepreneur, investor, advisor. Ron, you do a lot of stuff. I don't even know how to describe you without doing an episode that just says, "Meet Ron Shigeta." So that's why I love talking to you, man, because it's such a well-rounded approach. We would be remiss if we did this whole episode and we didn't give a couple how. I think that's pretty easy because I think that there's a few simple things. Would you like to start? Like, what are the best way to how to go about raising capital?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is to actually have something that people want. That you've built a company the investors want to invest in. And the other how is you have to learn how to tell people about it so that they understand it. those are the fundamentals. If you have those two, everything else is kind of, I can't think of anything that you have to have. There's a lot of important things they have, but if you don't have those, it's really not going to make it anywhere.
Yeah, I wanted to start my how with saying similar to what you just said is have a simple, clear message about not only like the problem that you're solving. I think the thing that people make mistakes on is they go into a pitch or they do any of it and they're just talking about features and no one gives a shit about features. It's the benefits that the features. So I always say FAB.
Add up into revenue. How's it going to add success by your definition? Right. What is your definition of success?
Well, I say FAB. So you have features, but you never should be talking about that without talking about the advantages and the benefits. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't just apply to your users. It also applies. What are the advantages of you investing in my business?
Yep. And you know,
why am I the bet to make?
You know, but even you know, sometimes those features are really mysterious. Like, one of the reasons Dropbox is so successful is not because their service is super reliable, they have strong value. But one of the reasons Dropbox is so big is because they used almost the same invite system that Clubhouse is using now. Do you remember that? I don't know if you ever, I use Dropbox. And early on, they say, oh, we'll give you an extra gigabyte if you're first somebody who jumps on the Dropbox.
If you invite four people.
I got like 3 gigabytes that way. And they got viral advertising. And storage costs nothing, right? So, you know, sometimes those features are not what you think they are.
I've told this story a bunch when it came to Gigabook, and that's why I was in Manhattan. I was talking to some people about that. And, you know, the thing was, is while it takes appointments online, it does this blah, blah, blah. Okay. You know what the real benefit it was is it gave our users peace of mind.
Mm-hmm.
It was one less thing to do. They could be providing services for their clients and not be going crazy about the phone call they missed, the phone call they had to return, or those phone calls coming in at 11:30 at night.
Well, and you just heard a way to make a pitch. Like, that's the pitch for Gigabyte. I mean, it's not about...
It gives you peace of mind. It unchains you from your business.
My cousin can write software, you know? Like, he doesn't write software anybody ever sees. You know, it's not the software. It's not the technical prowess. It's not how smart you are. I know we said it before. Let's say it again. It's what you do with those smarts, and how does that work? That's what you are to an investor.
Yeah, I have another thing that I heard. So a couple of years ago, I was at the Kansas City Tech Council's founders retreat or CEO retreat, and. Mm-hmm. I was listening to a panel of, well, one of them was Sandy Kemper, who's the founder and CEO of C2FO, who says, don't be afraid to sell people on your big vision.
That's right.
And that's the key. It's like too many people come in and they're like, well, you know, if we only get a million here, then maybe we'll be a $10 million company. That's a yawner.
They don't want
at the VC table. That's a yawner. That's a next pass or
instead of investing in you. Right.
Yeah. So have a big vision and don't be afraid to sell people on it, because you're sitting there talking about how you're going to make a $1 billion company. If you don't believe you will, why would they?
And, you know, people kind of think that they're not ready for something and they hold back. I think, you know, everything's very experiential. You've got to just sort of dive in and be a maker. And try something new every day, and you're going to learn by making little mistakes and big mistakes. You know, I think you have to learn about your product. Sometimes you have to ship it out there before it's ready, withdraw it, rebrand it, and ship it out again. You know, whatever you have to do to really learn how this actually works. Most of this advice is not for people like you and me, Matt. It's for people who are first-time founders, and you have to have that experience. You can do it with this project or the next project, but you have to be ready to fast prototype something. Get it out there and test it. If you can't, no one will know. You'll never know really what's going on.
Yeah, and I think the final how that I've got before we go to the Founders Freestyle and end this episode, which Ron, I'm glad you realized that we have never stayed within the normal time constraints of Startup Hustle episodes. So Ron told me before, he goes, yeah, but last time we talked for like an hour and 15 minutes, so I didn't schedule anything after that. I did the same. So, but, you know, the when it comes to the how is, you know, I am going to go back to this thing I've said so much. Tell those that you're investing how you're going to be great at one thing. Because one thing they don't want to hear is how their investment's going to go 7 different directions and you're not really great at one thing yet. Like,
I have a trick because it confuses people. Like, just before you said, don't forget to sell the vision, which is very expansive. And then you also want to say, do everything. And those are both true at the same time. And how it's true is this. The first word that we use is focus. So I'm going to do this in the next 2 years. I'm doing this. And it's very clear to me what we're doing. The result several years down the pike will be this vision. You can separate them in time. A lot of people just try to get to the focus part is what you're saying. And they don't get out. They don't talk about the long-term value of the company. You kind of need to show both ends of the process, now and then. If you do that, you can get that message across without contradicting yourself.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, and that's the thing is like, is if, well, I've just run into this a lot. I think the biggest mistake that founders make is trying to be good at six things before they're good at one. And that is that focus thing. So it doesn't mean you have to shelve the rest of your dreams for what you're building, but it's so much easier to, I tell people that once you have fire, it's easier to make more fire. It's the same kind of thing. Like once you get like, what's that's why you build an MVP. It's just simple. That's why you build an MVP. And investors are just very wary to put money into things that sound like just sound like a money pit. You're like, so what do you do exactly? Cause you're telling me six things. Where are you going to be aces? So, all right. So I end my episodes of Startup Hustle with what I call the Founders Freestyle. I say my episodes because I'm not the only host of Startup Hustle, and the Startup Hustle podcast is not the only form of Startup Hustle. We have a TV show now, which you can find on YouTube. It's a lot of fun. I think you'll enjoy it. Also check out Andrew Morgan's episodes on Tuesdays about Amazon and e-commerce, and join Innovate Her founder, Lauren Conaway, on Thursdays to talk about a lot of different kinds of stuff. Just go listen, check it out. Just believe me, we had listeners in 177 countries in 2020. We can't be that bad, can we? So we end Startup Hustle with the Founders Freestyle. Ron, what are your closing remarks? What would you like to tell the founders of the world about this very vast and broad subject?
I think I'm going to just land on what we just talked about, you know, get started. You know, everything should be a practice of daily doing something. And everybody from Gary Vee all the way to me say this, but I don't think people really understand what that means. It just, you basically show everything you're thinking. If you can translate your thoughts into some form of reality, even if it's very small, you know, you'll be a master in no time. It will not take long for you to get where you want to go, but you gotta be persistent.
Yeah, I think there's two things. One that we didn't mention is that raising capital is a full-time job. So expect mm-hmm. that. And you get ready for a lot of reps.
That's right.
I mean, I don't know if I know anyone who has just gone and given one pitch and they're like, boom, done.
Okay, corollary to that.
So get a lot of no's.
I mean, the corollary to that is your pitch sucks, right? You're not going to be good. Until you've raised money, you don't know that your pitch is good. And so you just have to keep going until you get that yes. By definition, no matter how good you feel about yourself, that's fine. You should feel good about yourself. You've been working hard, but you should never be satisfied with what you're doing until you land it. And you got to be okay with it.
Lots of reps. Yeah, I mean, and I think the last thing I want to say is, you know, don't assume that you're going to get meetings, but when you do, take them seriously. Like you mentioned, like some people won't even like dress themselves properly or whatever. Like you're usually going to, I think it's a fair assumption that you're almost always talking to type A individuals. If you go in to raise money, you need to get to the point, do it quickly. It's okay to get down to the bottom line. They don't want to hear 40 minutes about your features and shit like that. Like keep it short or you're going to lose their attention. And, you know, there's a lot of people with a lot of opportunities. You don't need to show up with an 80-page business plan. If you can't fit your idea and what you do on the front of one piece of paper, you've made it too complex. You haven't simplified it enough. Like for me, I just want to see your one pager. I want to hear what you have to say, 10 minutes or less. And if I'm interested in hearing or seeing more, then I'll ask for it.
Right. Actually, it should fit in your brain much less. Yeah. Than one. You know, if you can't spit it out there without referring to a piece of paper or a slide, you don't really care enough. That's how we used to.
My brain's like the size of a post-it note, so it's okay. I can't even get a full piece of paper out of it.
Five words. Yeah. You know, let's go. Right. You're talking to me.
Ron. Yeah. Ron, thanks for joining me for another great episode about this. If you guys want to check out more stuff that Ron does, check out the links in the show notes. Make sure you go watch Startup Hustle TV. We'd love to have your support, your comments, and your subscribes. So I'll see you around. See you, Ron.
Thanks.
Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time. We do it.